The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good morning. Today I wanted to talk about a couple of different factors that are important in practice and how they relate and how they can be balanced. And I'll say up front what they are, but we'll kind of develop it throughout the talk. So the first is a quality called faith or confidence or trust. People like different versions of that word, and I don't want to get too caught in the vocabulary, but those are a constellation around a certain idea. And then the second is wisdom or investigation, a constellation of qualities around that kind of idea. So these are both very important. And faith and wisdom, for example, are two of the five spiritual faculties. This is a list that's sometimes used in our practice. And the other three are energy, mindfulness, and concentration. But I want to focus on these two. There's one view of the faculties that says that faith and wisdom, which are the first and last of them, are to balance each other, actually, which is an interesting notion. It's very interesting to me, this idea of balance. There's even an image given in the texts of a chariot that's drawn by five horses, and they're intended to be represent these five faculties, and they're arranged such that mindfulness is the lead horse, and then behind it there are two pairs, and the first pair is faith and wisdom, and the second pair is energy and concentration. And it's said in this teaching that if confidence and wisdom are balanced and energy and concentration are balanced, then the lead horse has little work, which I like. I like that. And you can imagine this, right, with the chariot. If you've got five horses, they've kind of got to be coordinated, and especially if you've got two of them side by side and one of them's running really fast and the other one's plodding along, that's not going to be a smooth ride for the chariot. So I'm focusing on this first pair today. So this term, faith, and I apologize if that word triggers you. It's the one that I currently use the most often. But please consider also confidence or trust, and we'll talk about, you know, more practically what this means. Certainly it's not in Buddhism about belief, or blind faith, if you will. The Pali word that I'm talking about here, which doesn't really have an exact translation in English, that's why we keep using all these different words, the word is sadha, and this literally means to place the heart upon, to place the heart upon. So the idea is that you're offering your heart or giving your heart over to something in some way. It's actually often used as a verb, to do this placing. And I think we can get that intuitively, that this is what is involved. So sadha is, I think, essential at the beginning of an endeavor. It's some sense that something is possible, some inclination of the heart to move in some direction. We may be stepping right into darkness or uncertainty. Don't know what this step is going to mean, but only by taking the step is the light going to arise that tells us the next step to take. Sometimes it's like that, yeah? So this is conveying that. Maybe I'll take a little side turn to say that these five faculties, of which this quality, confidence or trust, is the first, are said to be qualities that we use all the time. They're just ordinary qualities of the mind that are needed in order to develop and master a skill or to walk a path, for example. But in a mundane sense, you would use these faculties to play the piano or learn to garden or learn to meditate. It's just, you know, where we're putting our heart. And so the very first one is about being willing to take this first step. And you're not going to do it unless you think there's something worth doing there. And so that's that, it's trying to capture that feeling where we say, okay, I'm willing. I'm going to try this. I'm going to try to learn this. There are a couple of nice quotes around this quality faith. It says, the last step depends on the first. And that's true. We have to start. If you don't start, you won't go. But it also says that the first step depends on the last. And so the aspiration that we have kind of sets the tone for the journey that we're doing. So how we start out matters. So this quality of faith or sadha is about inspiration and aspiration. There's also a sense in this quality of, I'll focus on the trust aspect now, of just allowing the process to work. There are parts of our development or of learning anything where we really have to not be using our rational mind, our evaluative mind, our assessment, our demands about how it go. Yeah, and that sometimes we have to just let the process do its work on us. And that's also part of this quality. So consider, for example, there are meditation instructions. Many of us have heard the instruction to sit down and follow the breath, or, you know, place the attention on the breath, except when something else becomes stronger. You know, there are other types of instructions. And one question is, what do we do with those? What is our attitude toward those instructions? Do we say, okay, that's what I'm going to do because that's the practice here. Let it do its work on me. Or do we say, you know, I tried that for 10 minutes and it wasn't that good, so I went to something else. Or I've worked on this for a while and now I think I'm going to try something different. I mean, there's sort of different ways to do it. But the maybe the attitude that goes with this quality of trust is one of giving yourself over to a practice, even if you don't know why or what it's going to produce. If your teacher says you should bow 108 times before you sit down every time to meditate, would you do it? It's an interesting question. I don't think there's a right answer at all times for all people. But this is the quality of that willingness. Okay, I'm going to do it. I'm going to see what that does. Another thing about this quality is that it changes over time, because faith and confidence are things that develop. They're part of the path. And so that quality for you may be different now than it was a few years ago. It may be different again in a few years. You can observe that it changes. For example, when I first came, very first time I came to sit with a sangha, I had been sitting on my own a little while. And then it finally occurred to me that there might be other people doing this too. And I located a sangha in my area at that time. And I went there, and I was immediately drawn to how the people who were clearly the leaders of the group, the advanced practitioners who'd been there for a while, was that they seemed very comfortable with themselves in a good way. You know, they were just being themselves. And at that time, I wasn't especially comfortable with myself. I felt a little awkward. I wasn't maybe doing the right thing in my life. And so suddenly I was very inspired by that. I mean, that just had an immediate effect on me. It's like, oh, I want to be like that. If I'm in this group, maybe I can be like that. So that was kind of an initial inspiration, I guess, to stay with the group and to stay sitting. And then later, I found that I had other aspirations, you know, other things. Once I'd been sitting for a while, the practice did a little work on me, and I started to imagine that there could be other things, too, that I could aspire toward. So this is normal, that the aspiration changes, the inspiration changes, the way we are placing our heart upon changes. And each time, I don't know if you want to reevaluate every month, that's probably a little soon, but you know, each time you kind of reevaluate the motivation, it's possible for different paths to be available to us, because the journey depends on how we take each step of the path. So I remember I said this was a quality that is balanced with other qualities in the mind. So it is possible to have a little too much of this quality relative to other qualities in the mind, this confidence or faith or trust. I don't know if you have too much confidence. I guess you could. But an imbalance that has too much faith could lead to credulity or overly devotional behavior. We could fall toward magical thinking. You know, if I just sit and pray forever, something will happen. Maybe it will, but it's possible that we would not have the oomph needed to shine the light and cut through ignorance. It's interesting that in the teachings of the Buddha, like if you look through the whole texts that we have of the discourses of the Buddha, have a lot of stuff in them. Lots of different messages, lots of different ways of conveying the teachings. And there are ones that where the Buddha is very clear that this quality needs to be strengthened in people. And he tells them, look, you're not wise, you need to do as I say. And sometimes he's a little tough about that. But not completely. He also advocates what I'm going to move into now, which is this quality of wisdom, which is practiced in the form of inquiry and investigation, you know, more those kinds of qualities. And wisdom itself, the Pali word is panya, is about seeing clearly, about seeing things as they really are. How are they? Usually they're changing. Often they're somewhat unsatisfactory, at least in the long run. And they're not really personal. But wisdom is kind of intelligent understanding that we've gained from experience. It's not intellectual knowledge or something that we heard from someone else. It's something that we really know for ourselves, because we've been there, we've done that, and we observed with mindfulness what was going on, and now we have some understanding. It's a little hard to talk about it in this way, because it sounds like it's something maybe you can acquire, get, and then you have wisdom. But I would approach wisdom more like faith, in the sense that it's a kind of a verb, like faith was to place the heart upon. And we can do that again and again, continually throughout the day, right? We can make that aspiration, make that movement. And in the same way, wisdom, I think, is more seen, more better to be seen as a verb, as something that we have a wise response, or we have a wise approach, or we have a wise way of seeing a certain moment. And we can renew that and do it again and again. It's not something that we get and hold on to. So wisdom, you know, at the deeper levels of meditation, wisdom is a direct seeing from a state of a calm mind, a clear mind. And it's particularly insightful seeing that can penetrate through our mental habits and our obscurations in the mind. So it's an important quality. The wisdom, the Buddha really favored wisdom. He really gave it a high position in his teachings. And he often encouraged people to really find out for themselves how things are. He praised that. He was less fond of obsequiousness, I would say, than of, you know, maybe finding our own path. And the Buddha wanted to foster people who were self-reliant. So there's a sutta called the Kalama Sutta, where the Buddha is talking to some people who are not explicit Buddhist followers at that point. They're questioning and they're trying to figure out what is valuable to them and how they want to practice and which of the spiritual teachers who come through their town is telling things that are useful. And the Buddha says, oh, well, then, here's a criterion for you. He says, don't go by reports, by legends, by traditions, by scripture, by logical conjecture, by inference, by analogies, by agreement through pondering views, by probability, or by the thought, this contemplative is our teacher. So he kind of pulls the rug out of a lot of the usual ways of knowing, including blind faith in the teacher, and including, you'll notice, intellectual deductive reasoning. He says neither of those are the way to go. Instead, he goes on to say, when you know for yourselves that these qualities are unskillful, these qualities are blameworthy, these qualities are criticized by the wise, these qualities, when adopted and carried out, lead to harm and suffering, then you should abandon them. And then there's the flip side. When you know that these qualities are skillful, praiseworthy, etc., and when you do them, they lead away from suffering, then you should adopt those. And when you read this at first, it's like, well, yeah, okay, well, how else could it be? But it's somewhat tricky to do this in practice. You know, how do we really know things and how can we be sure? But I read a lot of encouragement in this passage in that he says very clearly, you should check when these things are adopted and carried out, do they lead to harm or away from harm? You know, lead toward suffering or away from suffering. So he's actually saying you should try things. You should adopt things and carry them out. He's not saying if you make a mistake, that's it, you're a horrible yogi and you're, you know. He says, try it, and how are you going to know unless you try it? Now, he does add criticized by the wise and praised by the wise as also criterion for deciding things. So it's not purely your own personal opinion about what works and what doesn't work. Why? Because you're not 100% wise. So it's nice to check with other people. But you know, I like this. We're to investigate. He's very clear about that. So going back to the 108 bows that your teacher says to do before every sit, maybe an investigative attitude. So we've already learned that the faith attitude is that you just do it. You don't put your mind into it. You don't put your ego into it. Oh, it should be this way. I think I'd rather do it that way. You just do it. The investigative mind, also not ego-based, would have maybe a little bit of evaluation on that and do it and see, you know, after a certain amount of time, is this working? What does this feel like? Maybe tweak it a little bit. It's okay to do that. So, you know, you can understand that this is also an important way of learning by doing, essentially. And so you can, you know, you can check for yourself, well, which way does my mind go more often? Is there any imbalance there? An imbalance with an excess of investigation, this sort of testing out quality, can lead to a mind, if you don't have enough of the trust, it can lead to a mind that's clever and skeptical. and that, you know, you're always second-guessing yourself, you're always thinking that you know, you're always the one in charge of your practice. Boy, that's one we have to let go of. So it's ready to dismiss everything as dukkha. Oh, it's all dukkha, you know. I find this kind of mind to be brittle, sharp, cold, not very joyful. It's got to have a little juice, and the juice comes from the heart, from placing the heart upon. Do you see that there's a possibility of going too far in either of these directions? So this is why the Buddha favored balance in developing the mind. So I'd like to talk a little bit about what this kind of balance looks like among these two qualities. Remember, this is the idea that the lead horse has little work when the two horses that are paired are running together. When I first thought about the word balance, I have kind of a scientific background, and I thought about actually a mechanical balance, like a scale, you know, those old scales that had one pan on each side. And so then it kind of implied to me that we're weighing out our faculties in discrete chunks, and we need to add to the one that's weaker, basically, in each pair. But my understanding changed over time. I learned that that image in my mind was not very accurate. Actually, what happens is that the faculties interact as they come into balance. They're not really distinct things where you can add a chunk of one. So, for example, there was a time when I decided to cultivate more of the sadha, more of the faith and the trust. And so in the mechanical balance view, I would leave wisdom where it was, and I would add a chunk of faith, and that would balance the scale a little bit. But already, actually, deciding to cultivate any of the five faculties is an act of wisdom. So you can't really just add one. I had already increased wisdom before I even started. But just to talk a little bit about the process, I took up a bowing practice, which was really interesting for me because I didn't like bowing when I started practicing. You know, okay, maybe the bow that we do at the end of the sit, that was okay with me. But I'm talking about like prostrations. And I tried a prostration on my first retreat because I saw another yogi do it. And we're not talking like a full Tibetan prostration where you put your chest on the floor and your hands and legs out. This is more getting to your knees and putting the forehead to the floor, yeah? So I tried it once, and I didn't like it. I found it very unpleasant. It really, something in it just didn't resonate for me. And so at that time I just said, this is not for me, and I didn't inquire any further. Luckily, my teacher had not told me to do 108 bows before I started. But later, I went on a monastic retreat. And there, I received clear instruction in how to bow and what you're doing. So I actually received a little bit of help. And I learned that there was more to this bowing thing than I had allowed myself to see. And so then, I was able to take it up as a practice and actually observe with an open mind and heart what was going on. So I was actually using wisdom as I went along to inquire and investigate what is this about. And it was so insightful for me to discover, once I had that open mind, that this very simple bodily movement of essentially placing the head below the heart, if you will, it can awaken all kinds of things like generosity, patience, loving kindness, and also this quality of faith or confidence. It felt safe, it felt joyful. And so, and I learned that bowing is an act of renunciation. in order to get to the floor smoothly, there's a certain amount of letting go and coordination between the mind and the body. So I think done well, bowing is an embodiment of both faith and wisdom, actually. So it has both of those qualities. So the balance came about because I came to understand that this devotional practice is a tool for opening the mind and heart and seeing clearly. It actually weaves both faith and wisdom together. That was how it worked for me. I'm not saying it will be the same for everyone, but it was a really good practice to do. I have a lot of gratitude that that kind of came about. I'm willing, you know, I'm able to see the way those forces, if you will, faith and wisdom, come together and mutually balance each other. So images that are sort of more meaningful for me now in terms of balance are things like sheaves of wheat leaning against each other. You know, each one needs the other to stay up. Or boughs of a tree, two trees that are leaning together, something like that. And with the support of the other, each one can grow stronger in ways that it couldn't. It's kind of a harmonization and a resonance as opposed to this mechanical, you know, more mechanical view. There's a nice sutta where the Buddha talks about the way the path unfolds. And there's, you know, of course there's the Eightfold Path. That may be the one that we've heard most commonly. But in the, all through the teachings, the Buddha's telling again and again, this is how it works. This is what happens first, and then this next thing happens. And so you can interpret a lot of different paths from the written discourses. And there's a particular one that's repeated in a couple of suttas. It's kind of nice that I'll read. It's got, I think it's 12 steps. So it begins, the first step is this quality of confidence or trust. It says, with the arising of trust, the practitioner visits a teacher and grows close to the teacher. Growing close, he lends ear. I'll use the same pronoun for all of this. Lending ear, he hears the Dhamma. Hearing the Dhamma, he remembers it. Remembering it, he penetrates the meaning of the Dhamma. Penetrating the meaning, he comes to a reflective understanding of the Dhamma. With this reflective understanding, desire, or zeal is often used, arises. With the arising of zeal, he becomes willing. Willing, he contemplates. Contemplating, he makes an exertion. Exerting himself, he realizes with the body, the truth by penetrating it with wisdom. It's interesting, right? I know you didn't memorize all of those, so I'll highlight a few of them. So it begins with this trust, this confidence. As often happens, that's the beginning, because you gotta start. But notice that after that, he listens to the Dharma and remembers it, and then ponders it and reflects on the meaning, and grows to have an acceptance of it. So it says, after you've engaged, then check it out and actually decide, oh, this makes sense. This, you know, now that I've gone a little farther into this and received some instruction, yes, it resonates, it makes sense for me. And from that, the person is inspired to really practice. This part about zeal and willingness and exertion, those are words that are talking about the part of the path where we're sitting on the cushion and really engaging with the inner work that this practice asks of us in order to let go of the clinging in the mind that we have. And because those are getting pretty far up in the sequence, and then because of that exertion, he's able to penetrate with wisdom the this says the truth, I think we could say, comes to an understanding by penetrating with wisdom. Eventually, through this process, you know, comes to free the mind, free the heart. So it's interesting, right? This is a path, actually, that it's disguised, but it's based on the five faculties. It started with faith. It ended with penetrating with wisdom, right? And in between, we didn't talk about the other faculties, but the other ones are energy, mindfulness, and concentration. And that's what's used to engage with the teachings and to practice. So the five faculties, which are just basic qualities of mind used for learning a skill, also form the Buddhist path, beginning with our willingness to start and ending with the realization of freedom. I think it's also worth noting that the Buddha himself did both of these. He balanced confidence and wisdom on his path. He had to have faith because, I don't know if you know the story of the Buddha that's come down to us in our tradition, but he went and, after he decided to embark on the spiritual quest, he went and practiced with a couple of the best teachers in his area who were teaching concentration practices of various kinds, and he mastered those and realized that his mind still wasn't free. No teacher, you know, there was nobody else to teach him, so he struck out on his own. That's faith. You know, to say, what I'm going for, even though I can't find anyone else who knows it, I know it can be found. That's pretty confident. And that led him to go first do some ascetic practices, realize that wasn't the path, but eventually to sit under the Bodhi tree and realize, you know, realize Nibbana, you know, free his mind. And along the way, he used wisdom, right? He assessed that these concentration teachers hadn't given him what he was looking for. He assessed that the self-mortification practices that he engaged with were not leading to freedom either. He tried that next. So there was discernment. He was assessing his path, deciding. But he still had the confidence. You know, I know it's there. I know. I can't see it, but I can... It's going to be there, but this isn't it, and this isn't it. He's using both, and eventually that brought the fruit when those both became very strong. So these qualities, sometimes balance makes it sound like things can need to oppose each other in some way. But my understanding of this idea of balance is that the stronger each one gets, it can pull the other one along, and they both can mutually resonate laser-like and, you know, become stronger and stronger when they're in balance. It's only when they're out of balance that they're fighting against each other. The horses can run faster and faster if they're both going the same speed. It's only if they're not going the same speed that you have a problem. Yeah. So maybe for your reflection, you could consider a couple different angles on this to think about this balance in your own practice. So first of all, when has it been good to just accept, you know, to just do the practice and not think that you know how to do it, think that you know better? Have there been times when something amazing opened up that you could never have imagined, in which your judgmental mind would probably have rejected, but because you just opened, it was possible? And then there's also, have there been times in your practice when you needed to dig in, to make assessments, to ask questions? Were you too gullible? Were you just swallowing things and cruising along or having magical thinking that it would all just happen? And you realize now that it would have been better to engage more in probe and have a deeper, you would have gotten to a deeper experience by doing some inquiry. Let me add that this doesn't have to happen on any particular time scale. Sometimes it's, we have to check also whether we're evaluating our practice at the right intervals. I mean, sometimes if you're sitting on the cushion, there's a tendency to evaluate every 5 minutes. Okay, am I getting calm yet? No. Let me try something different. I'll try metta practice. You know, maybe that's a little too much. Or it's possible to, you know, not evaluate for 20 years and be drifting along. So there are many time scales. You can, you know, months or years are interesting, kind of interesting time frames to look at. I'm thinking as I'm saying this that in my own practice, when I first started, I was just really taken by the teachings, and I felt, I just knew that there was something really important there for me, even though I couldn't quite articulate it. And it's interesting for me because I have a very scientific background and tend to have a rational mind. At least that's the part that I ended up developing more in the early part of my life. And something in me intuitively realized when I started practicing that that part was going to hold me back in certain ways. I might have too much of that. And so I actually deliberately let go of rational thought about the practice. I mean, maybe not completely, but you know, for a number of years, I didn't read the texts. I didn't want to do any academic study because I knew I would think too much about what was going on. I just needed to sit, just needed to hear Dharma talks. I needed to go on a lot of retreats. But I found eventually that phase, I won't say came to an end exactly, things just sort of turn into new things. But there came a time when suddenly I was interested in reading the texts more carefully, taking a couple of academic Buddhist studies classes. Now I'm starting to learn Pali. My rational mind, my thinking mind, is coming back in because it needs to be integrated. There needs to be this balance. So I think it's good to be very open about how these balances come about, how these different factors in the mind grow and develop. My sense is that with mindfulness, if we're willing to just be mindful of not only our experience, which is the practice, but mindful of how it's unfolding over time, then I think the balance comes about by itself, maybe sometimes with the help of a teacher. So I offer this as a way of looking at two very important factors in our practice: the willingness to just let the process happen, to place our heart into it and not think and evaluate, and the ability to assess and discern and eventually penetrate with insight what's happening. Can we bring both of these into our hearts and into our practice? And that really helps the path, really helps us move along the path. Okay, so we have a few minutes for questions or comments. Anybody? Yeah, John, would you mind grabbing the microphone? It should be turned, you'll have to press the button, but it's the, yeah, that one, just press the button.
Yeah.
Great.
So I did 108 bows at a temple all
did
the time.
Did you? Yeah.
And what it is it's a concentration practice when you're in a group of
people. Yes, that's right.
Because you have to keep track of the 108 bows, and you don't want to be the last. In the last bow, you bow your head down, and you don't want to get up again and do another bow. When your head is down,
yeah,
then you know you've got the right number, and it becomes a concentration practice, but it also becomes, it gives you a lot of insight.
So yeah, so you say insight into what?
Into being more calm.
Uh-huh, yeah.
More relaxed.
How can you do this in a way that's calm and relaxed? Yeah.
But it is definitely a concentration practice.
Yes. Okay.
In a group.
Thank you.
Are insight and wisdom the same? Can we use those words interchangeably? Is the way I was
not
thinking.
Not quite.
Okay, because the way I was thinking of it was, and faith is a form of, I think of that as surrender.
Mm-hmm. That's another
nice
word for it,
me.
Yeah.
Surrender. And often that's where insight arises.
Yes, good point.
And my question was, and maybe this is wisdom, I don't know, how do we allow insight to penetrate our lives?
That's a great question. And surrender is one way, for sure. I think the question is maybe, what is being surrendered in, and there's a lot of ways that we could attempt surrender. But if what's being surrendered is kind of the self, the control, you know, the ego, to use a Western psychological term, then that's the same thing that has to get out of the way for wisdom to arise also. So I think you've hit upon kind of the barrier to, and the ego is also what prevents us from surrendering, because we say, I'm not going to do that, or I can't do that, or something. There's an I in there about, you know, kind of getting in the way. And when that can be let go of, and it can be let go of through devotional practice, or it can be let go of through seeing that it's just something impermanent, it's just being created by the mind. Those are two different doorways to this surrender, which opens to insight. Does that make sense? Am I addressing what you're pointing toward?
That's good. Then when the insight occurs, I think what I heard you saying right at the beginning, which is, then there's another surrender to the insight or the truth that's seen.
Oh, this is a good
point.
To
allow it to penetrate and inform our living, you know?
There are kind of two steps, certainly. There's the initial seeing, and this is well supported in the discourses. There's kind of an initial seeing, and then which is the insight, I suppose. And then there's the living of it, the reflection on it, the integration of it, which is another aspect of wisdom. I think wisdom is bigger than insight. Maybe it includes that moment of insight, but then there's also the response. Remember, I talked about wisdom as a verb, as how we approach life, and that becomes possible through what we've learned by seeing, but it still has to be done. It still has to be done, yeah. This is a lifelong path for many. Anything else? All right, thank you.